episode 37 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick.
And together.
Oh, that's me. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast. Oops.
So we are recording today on June 4th. It's a Saturday. It's been kind of a crazy week for me because it's winding down to the school year.
Having lots of problems with our microphone. Mm-hmm. So just, I don't know, something to do with the computer controlling it. But anyway.
Working out the bugs.
Yeah, hopefully it won't sound too bad.
Yeah. So this week, would you like to start with biology since we usually start that way? So I found something in the news section in science, and it's just come out this week. And it's a landmark study about pepper moss. Isn't that cool? So this is the same pepper moss that we learned about as showing Darwin's natural selection. And
are those the ones in like industrial England where...
Exactly.
With the soot, okay.
Yeah. And so we had this huge changeover to the moss becoming dark. And then as the coal was removed from the air, they switched back in the 1970s to white, the way they are today.
There was also a difference between like in the cities versus in the countryside.
Exactly. Exactly.
I remember a picture of one in our biology books from
So I show it, like, you know, we talk about it. Uh-huh. There's even this little online app that they could go in and hunt for moths on different conditions, white trees and dark forests. It's funny. Anyway, so, you know, there's been studies going on, for a while about what causes mutation to take place. And the scientists assume that the mutation would be, connected with the coloration, a gene responsible for coloration. And that's not it. So it's just this cool study.
I would have always assumed that there was no mutation, that the morph was already there. It's just a change in the frequency of...
So the mutation is is caused by the insertion of a portion of DNA that jumps to a new location on the genome.
Oh, okay. Yes. Like a transposon.
Yeah. And so in this particular case, it's in the cortex, around the cortex center, and it causes that mutation to take place. And they think that mutation is also the mutation that is responsible for patterns.
Hmm.
So that would give a certain patterns that butterflies have on their wings. Yeah. So I thought it was just a really cool study. It's actually two different studies that were done.
Uh-huh.
It'll be fun to have their actual papers published.
Yeah.
This was in news, so I don't know if it's actually hit the press or this is a release of what an up-and-coming article.
Yeah.
So, but fun. I just thought, wow, that's a neat one. I'll have to save to bring into class and go on, you know, about mutations being important for that, one of the mechanisms for evolution. So I was like, what a nice connection. So, do you have any biology?
I was just looking. I have some biotech. I don't really have any pure biology.
So I must have had a serious bio bug this morning.
You go again.
Because I found this other thing, and this was published, the editor's choice in Science, and it's the most recent Science. So it was just released this week. And it talks about this plant, and it's this plant that will accumulate salt to stop from freezing.
How cool.
I just thought it was so neat.
Yeah.
So they have this special cells, and I think you'll get into the cell part. So they're specialized trichomes, uh-huh. and they're known as epidermal bladders. Is that fun?
Uh-huh.
And so they're the epidermal bladder cells uh-huh. found on the surface of ice plants, and they can accumulate salt. And they accumulate like 1 molar solutions of salt to stop from freezing.
Oh, yeah. I've done a lot on mechanisms to stop freezing.
Yeah.
And even freezing to preserve life, to make it through a really cold snap.
Yeah.
That was like when we were undergraduates
yeah.
and looking at frogs and stuff and insects. Neat. Yeah, 1 molar would really lower your freezing point. That's amazing.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a very short article. The article is actually out of BMC Plant Biology,
mm-hmm.
and it was just recently published. Anyway.
That is cool.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah. The stuff that is interesting, that I found the most interesting thinking way back, like the wood frog.
Mm-hmm.
And some other frogs. That's the one I look at the most.
Mm-hmm.
They will, these terrestrial frogs will hibernate in like piles of leaves and decaying matter, which mm-hmm. keeps them slightly above the
yep.
environmental temperature, right? But sometimes you get a cold snap and they've
right.
got to make it through and it starts to freeze them. And if they freeze, in the cells, they'll die.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way around that. And if they freeze the extracellular fluid uncontrollably, then ice crystals will grow in all different directions and pierce tissues
mm-hmm.
and kill them that way. So they have special systems, one, to lower the freezing point by increasing concentrations of osmolytes, and
mm-hmm.
they have specific ones in the different animals. The other is they actually on purpose nucleate ice crystals to keep them really small, and they will on purpose freeze extracellular fluid, which really increases the osmolarity inside the cells,
mm-hmm.
preserves them, and stops these long crystals from forming. It's a fascinating...
That's
and people
too
have
cool.
studied that in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
You know, slowly or more quickly freezing frogs
mm-hmm.
To different extents. It's not really freezing them as much as exposing them to cold that causes them to have this reaction
mm-hmm.
for different amounts of time and seeing what happens.
You could kind of see how Gary Larson could do some damage with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, dear. Okay. So.
Oh, my gosh. I just realized there's a huge amount that was really interesting that I forgot to look at. I mean, I looked at, but we didn't discuss. Wait, so we're talking about plants. Did we talk last time about the Venus flytrap?
Yes.
Okay. So that's
mm-hmm.
done. So then I really don't have any other...
Okay.
I have some plant-related stuff, but it's biotech.
Okay.
And, well, go ahead. Do you have stuff?
I don't. Now my things become more... technology and educational.
So this is more of a news piece. You saw it.
Yeah,
might
I was
be...
really interested in that.
Yeah.
I'm
so it's not huge amounts of information. Basically, India is maybe going to allow GM mustard to be grown and sold.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be their first...
GM crop.
Well, it'd be their first edible one. They've had cotton for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
There's huge amounts of opposition from farmers groups and I don't know all the different groups that oppose this.
Are the seeds, do they have a patent on the seeds?
I think this is research being done
okay.
by several groups that are not necessarily, I don't know if there's patent issues
okay.
with this. I don't really know much of the legal on here. What I do know is the biology of what they're trying to do and why this is the one that's coming up now. Mm-hmm. India is the largest producer of mustard by land area, but not by crop yield. So in other words, they have more land devoted
to mustard.
To mustard growth.
Got it.
Than any other country. But they don't have the highest production.
Ah.
And I don't know if it's particular in India, but they have varieties that it's for the leaves and I can't remember what else.
Yeah, oil. Actually, I just got it. And leaves, oil, I think. And cooking oil.
Yeah. And they have varieties they like in India. And it turns out that the varieties they like there and the hybrids that make it better at having higher yield and also, I suppose, meshing well with pest resistance and so on, they haven't been able to get this combination. Mm-hmm. So that's why their yield remains low. Biologically, the reason for this is that the mustard plant has both male and female parts.
Oh, neat.
And, yeah. And
kind of like the corn.
I guess. I don't know much about the corn right now. But the problem is when you go to make a cross, you know, you figure, okay, so you have a plant with one particular gene that you like, and you have a different hybrid with a different one, and you cross the two, and the problem with the mustard, because it's got both male and female, they self-pollinate. So a huge number of the seeds are actually the original plants you started with without any cross, right? So making crosses and getting high yields is just very difficult for research. And there's ways around that, but it's a lot of work. And mostly it has to do with creating systems that cause one plant to fail at producing one of the two sexes. Usually it's the male.
Right.
So you make it that they can't produce pollen. And then you have one hybrid that has a system that counteracts that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're able to do your cross. Because the male is missing, you have only female plants instead of plants that have both male and female. They can't self-pollinate. Then you cross it with your other plant that has the counteracting gene, and now you end up with a plant that's the cross you wanted, and it can be bred. And but it's been really difficult to get that to work. And now they have a GM way of putting in, I think it's a gene used. So canola is also that way. And there's GM canola in Canada.
Yeah.
And they're using the gene from that system. That it's actually a bacterial gene rather.
GMS system.
Yeah. Or a CMS system.
Oh, sorry, CMS.
So CMS, if I remember correctly off memory, is the original mustard one. It's not the canola, I don't think. But it's a bacterial gene instead of a, what's that? Cytoplasmic male sensorially, CMS, right?
Yeah.
So that's, I think, the mustard system, and it's from one of the hybrids. The Canadian GM canola, it's basically the same type of system, but it's a bacterial gene rather than a natural gene. That's where the GM comes in. And they're inserting it in the mustard. Yeah, so they're thinking that that might be the way forward. So we'll see if it all gets approved and stuff. We'll see what happens.
So with this, they'll be able to self-pollinate.
Well, no, with this, they can stop the self-pollination then come up with the hybrids that they've never had before for mustard that are both high yield and have all the genes that make it that it's the style they like in India that's being sold right now.
Right.
So then,
right, and the texture and everything that's important
for that market.
Yeah.
Exactly.
To actually be enticed to it.
Yeah. So the upshot would be simply an increase in the yield in India.
Okay.
Feed more people. Of course, there's the typical issues about, well, is that going to contaminate what they call land races, which are a big source of biodiversity for mustard in India, and...
Right, and the number of varieties.
Yeah, exactly.
There may be, you know, several varieties that have slightly different, you know,
they have
textures, tastes.
Well, I think it's not as much the variety for textures, taste, but just the fact that you have a huge pool of biodiversity.
Right.
Means that your system is resilient.
Right.
Right.
Well, over the long run.
Right. Yeah. So if you wipe out the biodiversity by introducing this one super crop, then what if something bad happens in the future, then you've got nothing to fall back on.
Right. And the story of the potato famine comes back.
Yeah. That type of stuff. I mean, a lot of people are saying that that's just not a problem. Right. But that's what the issue is. Or one of the issues.
Right.
And there's biosafety data also that hasn't been released. And
very interesting.
So people aren't sure, you know, why that is.
That'll be a neat story to follow.
Yeah, yeah. We covered some of the GM cotton stuff a while back in India. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the new government was really looking at bringing GM trials back online slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Anyway, so, yeah, that's the India one, GM mustard.
Okay. See. And,
I have no other bio.
Okay.
Well, I have a CRISPR kind of one.
Right.
That's kind of bio, it's more technology.
Okay.
So.
Oh, I have a biology one. Silly me. I have it right here, pardon me. I think, I totally forgot about this. It must have closed on me.
You're going to kill me when you realize what we forgot, because I reviewed my articles before this, like we always do, and then you had been working on the blog, so I went off doing something else, and I totally forgot. Anyway, you go ahead.
Okay, so here's a very strange thing that I just read about, and this is from the Science June 4th issue, and it is in a news brief.
Yeah.
And basically... there's been what they call the battle over the rattlers. And there's been this practice in Texas.
Uh-huh.
And they would use, since 1958, they would use gas, like as in gasoline, to get the rattlers out of cracks and crannies and wherever they are. And they're trying to stop this practice because it's also killing out insects and everything else that lives in that particular area.
Right. See. So how do they use gasoline? Is this without lighting it?
Or? Yeah, without lighting it.
Okay.
Yeah. They didn't say about burning specifically in the article.
Uh-huh.
It was just about, getting them out, and they are killing them, and they collect like thousands of them, like about 2,000 in these like collections.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not just Texas. There's actually 29 states that do this, but Texas is one of them. And they're trying to stop the practice.
Hmm.
So I never even knew that it existed. And so that's very bizarre.
Yeah.
And if it's done from year to year. And it's the fumes that are fatal.
Right.
To the snakes. So in November, they're going to come up with a final ruling about whether this practice is going to continue.
Okay.
The other thing that I read about, and this goes, you know, along with biodiversity and that, is the Great Barrier Reefs. And shocking, like 35% of the corals in the northern and central sections of the Great Barrier Reef have been killed in the last year.
This is like a bleaching type thing?
Yeah, it's like, and it's due to like warmer waters.
Yeah.
They have an El Nino year, or we all do,
uh-huh.
and that's the impact it has on them, that they get...
Well, this is in a single year, 35%?
Yeah, that's what I understood. And
wow.
It's like they are, the Great Barrier Reef is going to be a destination at risk chapter in the United Nations.
Yeah, Great Barrier Reef is a deeper reef than the way we usually think of these coral islands and stuff.
Right.
And you figure, wow.
So that was a big shocker to me.
Yeah.
I know we'll hear more about it, but it was just, you know, to see the numbers and that, it was pretty shocking. And this one, my final one.
Okay.
And I thought of our friend.
Am I looking at cell phone cancer?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Revive fear of cancer. So they've been radiating these rats, and they found out that the male rats were more susceptible to the radiation given out by cell phones than females.
But what were the rats getting?
That's what I was wondering.
Were they getting cancer, or were they getting brain damage?
Brain cancer.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Brain and heart. And
watch it. It's something like they're putting the cell phone, they're getting brand new cell phones to do this, and the cell phones are degassing.
Yeah.
And it's actually the fumes from the plastic.
This is a preliminary data share out.
Yeah.
But get this, it's going on, like it's not going to finish for another year or so.
Yeah.
The data isn't, like they aren't set to finish their scheduled collection till 2017. But listen to this. So the males are affected.
But
the females are not. And in fact, they actually live longer on average.
Wow. Okay.
So there's like this bizarre study. So, you know, it's one of those things that people are upset because, you know, there's been some finding in it.
Yeah.
And so they're starting to say, hey, we need more information about this, and the U.S.
So
food and drug.
I hear that those types of results, and I'm like, oh, I get results like this all the time in the lab.
Yeah.
And it's just overfitting the data.
Right.
In other words, you do enough, you will find blips here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. I just noticed on the bottom of your article, bit.ly cell cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I just discovered these shortened URLs.
Oh, yes.
Remember?
Yeah.
I can't believe. And I was so excited. I was telling everybody about this. It's like everybody knows already about tiny URL and bit.ly.
Yeah.
Anyway. So.
Yeah. They're awesome.
Okay. One of mine?
Yep.
I want to do my big one, because I've got a feeling we might be finishing up pretty soon. I mean, we're not like even half hour into it, but it's kind of going longer than I thought.
So new batteries.
Yeah. So this is about batteries, and it's about a particular researcher, Yi Cui. Y-I and then C-U-I is the second.
Is he American or Chinese? Or
So he was born in China. He's currently at Stanford and does research, but also has his own company called Amprius in California.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he's now American or if he's still Chinese, but he's been here for a long time.
Neat. I was just wondering where the research was being done because I hadn't read the article. It's in California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So, here's the thing: batteries have been around forever.
Yeah.
If you look at technologies all over the world, with new information coming in from research, all sorts of different processes have just since the 1900s or 1950s have, you know, quadrupled or orders of magnitude greater, you know, process speeds or abilities and whatnot. And if you look at batteries, let me see, I think, yeah, this one stat kind of says it all. Lithium ion cells right now, the best ones, do 700 watt hours per liter, so that's energy density, if you want.
Right.
And that's about five times of the NiCads that we had in the 1980s. Yeah, so, you know, we're not talking about orders of magnitude difference here, and it's been a long time. And huge companies are doing research, right? So what is this guy going to do that's different? Well, it turns out everybody's basically fiddling with three things. The chemistry, right? And it's the chemistry of the electrodes in the batteries. The electrolyte.
Yeah.
And what else? Maybe that's about it. So those are the big things. And what he's doing, well, he was actually originally a nanotech type person.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah. And you know, there's so much nanotechs out there and people do a bit of research and are able to create some tiny
small
little
model
thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, woohoo, we've done this, right? And it's like, yes, this
but it's
will
kind of
probably
a standalone for now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like there'll be great applications for that in the future, like when someone can finally figure out how to use the fact that, you know, we can print. Hello, this is MIT saying hi with letters, you know, that are tiny. I can't remember where they first did this with carbon. But anyway, but this, he's already has his batteries in cell phones that are being sold. And his, the ones that are actually on the market now, can store 10% more energy.
I just noticed that.
And the research has been able to do way more than that since then. And why is this different? Because he's making his electrodes out of nanomaterials, which means he can control the structure while everybody else is controlling only the chemistry. So now it's a two-dimensional problem, right? There's a lot more things you can tweak, trying different chemistries with different structures. The space is huge.
And surface area probably makes a difference in changing the surface area available for the connection.
Of course, that's the first thing we think about. But it actually turns out that it's way more than that because different chemistries, depending on the geometry around the molecules and stuff, act differently.
Yeah.
So right now, the anode is pretty much always carbon.
Yeah.
And with the lithium batteries, at least when you charge them, you get lithium ions that migrate to the carbon. And I think, if I remember correctly, I can't find it, I think it's like six carbon atoms will hold a lithium ion. And so that works fairly well. It turns out if you use silicon, I might be making a mistake here, but I think a single silicon can hold, let's try to find it before the end of the talk.
I thought I saw silicon. I'll look while you
talk. I think it can hold four lithium ions. And what that means, I mean, we're going from six carbon to hold it.
Yeah, silicon.
Is it? Where's?
Right here.
Right. Each silicon can hold four lithium ions. While before, six carbon can hold a single lithium. So this is an order of magnitude difference. It's huge. Plus, on top of that, silicon is lithium. Well, I don't know. I'm not going to go into. So silicon is the next step. Lithium would be even better, like a, where lithium is not just the ion, but it's also in the anode. So he's working on both, but the silicon is where he's had the most success. And up to now, the problem's been that when these lithium ions enter the silicon, then, you know, this is a bulk piece of silicon, and it swells a lot, which means you have an awesome battery the first time you charge it. Mm-hmm. But then it shrinks when you use it, then it swells again and it starts to crack, and very quickly you've destroyed your battery. You've destroyed your anode, basically. Mm-hmm. And so he's coming up with nanotech, different structures where the shrinking is not a problem, mm-hmm. or there is no shrinking. And he's getting all sorts of problems. So one of them was he made these little wires out of silicon. And I can't remember their diameter, but they're super thin. And there, you don't have the problem with the shrinking and collapsing. And he was able to get batteries that, let me see, I can't remember, but they could go through an just huge numbers of cycles and keep going. Problem is, the wires are super expensive to make. So that's no good. But it does show it's possible in one way to make a battery that has way more capacity. So then he started to make these, they're kind of like spheres, mm-hmm. and the spheres could hold, they could swell and shrink again. And so that worked well, but then there's like a binder around it and that would crack. And then he came up with a way to put a sealer around that. And you can see there's all these incremental steps. Mm-hmm. The point is, with everyone, he's gotten closer to getting, you know, he's gotten more out of it, mm-hmm. and more longer life cycle and more charge into a certain volume. While everybody else is just making just tiny little steps. So I think he's ready right now that the next set he can get 40% more charge than what he's been doing with the cell phones. And he hasn't started with cars yet, but he thinks he's like almost there for getting batteries into cars. And anyway, very exciting.
Very nice.
Yeah.
That's huge.
From where he is now, it looks like there'll definitely be some cars in the future. Mm-hmm. That's maybe in the next 10 years or so. Yeah. That will have the same range as gasoline cars.
Oh, wow. That would be just so incredible.
It would be a game changer.
It would. Yeah. It would. It would make them suddenly have a bigger piece of the market.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's nice. Very nice.
Anyway, that was my battery one. I really wanted to do that one.
I have a few. Oh, you didn't do CRISPR.
I didn't. Do you want me to do the CRISPR one?
Yeah, because I wanted to hear the CRISPR. Okay, so
there's no perspective on this. This is just a pure research article. Uh-huh. I actually didn't read it. I read the abstract and I looked at the figures. And the reason I want, you know, we have to talk about CRISPR every time.
I know.
So this is another reason that I think this is all this hype is around CRISPR, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. It's just one more different way that someone's come up to advance research because CRISPR's so cheap and easy to use.
Right.
So it's basically...
And reliable.
Yeah.
To a certain... You know,
well, for research.
Yeah, for research. Right? Yeah.
So, this is the basic problem. You have organisms that have certain phenotypes, and you want to find out what are the genes. And so you cross them. You have many generations. and you look at which parts of the genome have crossed, have recombined, and what are the phenotypes of the offspring. And when you see that some phenotypes always stick together, and one part of the genome is always together in those offspring, then you're like, aha, okay, so these traits are in this area. But you're relying on these crosses that are happening at very long distances along the genome. So narrowing it down to a particular gene is really, like, it's impossible, right? So what do? You bring CRISPR along, and once you have a general idea, you on purpose send in CRISPR to cut the genome at regular intervals all along that stretch. Mm-hmm. And instantly, you have all of these pre-made crosses. And sure enough, some of the offsprings have, you know, a whole bunch of offspring have it. As you cut further and further down the genome and you reach a spot, boom, suddenly none of the offsprings from further down the genome have mm-hmm. the phenotype. And so you've just identified the gene. And they were able to identify a particular spot within a gene where you had a variation in the genome that caused this one phenotype. It happened to be, for in this article, sensitivity to manganese, I don't remember the organism. I think it was yeast.
It was yeast.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah. And so, yeah, one more use for CRISPR.
How cool.
So you can imagine a whole bunch of people using this technique to identify genes now.
Yeah.
It's not identifying genes. It's matching up genes that we have from sequencing to a phenotype.
Right.
That's what it's doing.
Yeah.
I thought it was really cool.
That is. That's a very nice connection.
Okay. I only have two more kind of three more.
I have two more. They're educational based and they're very short.
Okay.
Do you want me to do those?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. One is it's another one from the editor's choice.
Uh-huh.
And it's from the June 4th edition of Science.
Uh-huh.
And it's when they choose from other magazines.
Yep.
And
editor's choice.
And, you know, I just copied it so I could cut and paste it and mail it to people because I feel strongly about kids making mistakes to learn.
Uh-huh.
And it talks about a important part of STEM is being able to reflect on failure.
Uh-huh.
So why did it not, you know, what caused it to fail? Like, what happened?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you would have done this one thing, you think that it would have worked, you know?
Yeah.
And it's having them problem solve and question working, not working, and then if it's not working, then how could it be done mm-hmm. differently and better? So I loved it. And very short paragraph
about it. So
this
was actually research done about what mm-hmm. happens when kids
right.
fail and learn. And yeah. it's set up on purpose to
right.
have them learn from the failure.
Yeah. So there's even one professor where he would have the students take a test.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would give them all the answers to the test
mm-hmm.
after.
Mm-hmm.
And he would give incentives for students to look and to reevaluate how they answered it and rework what they've done.
Hmm.
And when he did that in, you know, throughout the year, the final examination scores were much higher.
Okay. What level?
This was at college.
College level. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought was, you know, is applicable to any level
yep.
of student. But I just feel strongly about it and having mm-hmm. students have that opportunity. Another school one.
Okay.
And it's inclusion in school gifted programs.
Uh-huh.
So our school gifted programs are not very diverse in the sense of...
Yeah, right. Oh,
you know,
I know exactly
yeah.
what you mean. I mean, we're not going to go into that,
yeah,
but I know what you're saying.
And it's just such a frustration
yeah.
Because it's obvious and it's noted by all.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And this article says that, you know, the problem with the inclusion programs in schools right now is that the students being chosen for the program are being chosen by teachers and people with the same ethnicity.
Right.
And but, the African American students or black students, they are more apt to be recommended for a program from teachers who are also
African
American.
Even when I assume this is something that will be very sensitive to letting teachers know that this is an issue in a particular place, right? Not across the board.
Right, and talking about,
because it's like bystander intervention. Once you're told,
aware.
Oh, everybody's doing this.
Right.
And, but the other problem that I see with that, I've heard from, I don't know who, is there's issues with the parents. The parents, a lot of parents really push to have their kids being put, and there's only so many kids you can put in these classes. And then what do you do when the mix ends up not being what you wanted because you've got all this pressure and complaints by people that want their kids in there, even though the kids don't necessarily fit?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't need the program.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway,
just an important thing to remember and reflect on.
I was thinking of keeping this short, so I'm going to skip one of mine. And I've got two left. So one is from Linux Voice, issue 28, and it's about, so we're totally going a different direction now. It's about support vector machines, and it's a form of artificial intelligence where you have learning, and then after the learning phase, you have actually tests of real world data, and that's what you use. And it turns out that there's Python library, so I hate Python, but anyway, there's a Python library that they tested out, and they have a neat little tutorial. It's on page 92. How to use it. They use a very simple example, and it's really neat. The way support vector machines work is, the way they say it works, right, is let's say you pick random points and you have a circle, and your job, this is their example, by the way, your job is to find all the points that are inside the circle as opposed to outside. And support vector machines, the way they handle this type of data is they try to draw a line on your 2D area that separates the valid points from the invalid points. Right? Really, you should think about it as a surface, because obviously 2D stuff is very easy to visualize and to test out. But turns out that these libraries can handle many dimensions. So you have to think of a surface, you know, because most of your real problems will not be two-dimensional. They'll be a lot more complicated than this. And this can handle it fine. Yeah, and it's just really neat. There's one part that they say, that they talk about, where I guess it's really difficult to have good data sets for learning, for the learning part. And of course, if you don't have the right data set, then the outcome from the real data is going to be incorrect, because it's not going to be looking for what you're looking for. And they have what's called the parable of the tanks. And so because it's a parable, I assume this never happened.
Right.
But the story goes like this. The U.S. Army wanted to identify hidden tanks in bushes, right? So they took a bunch of tanks, put them in the bushes, took a bunch of pictures, and then they had the people in the tanks drive away. They came back the next day, took a bunch of pictures of the bushes, fed them all into this learning system that analyzed the images, told them these are the ones with thanks, these are the ones without, and sure enough, the learning system figured out exactly how to identify whether there was a tank there or not. And then they went out and took some more pictures from different areas and stuff, and then fed them in, and it totally failed. And it couldn't identify at all where the tanks were. And it turns out, the first day, when they took the picture of the tanks, it was sunny. And the and then on the second day, when they came back after the tanks had been driven away, it was cloudy. And so it had learned to identify the weather. The parable of the tanks. Oh, so, but I think the lesson here is that you might, you know, two-dimensional stuff, yeah, that's easy. But higher-dimensional stuff, you're going to feed it all sorts of data that you think is telling it what you want it to learn. But with high-dimensional stuff, you might have something that you never even think about that it's able to pick out. And it's learning. This is true artificial intelligence, right? It's figuring this out, and you have no idea what it's figuring out. And it's matching what you're giving it. And it's like, yes, I figured it out. And you look at it, yep, it's figured it out. But it's actually something totally unexpected that it's figured out. So anyway, interesting problems. That was cool. Cool article. Okay, I only have one more thing. And when you find out about this, you're going to be so angry. I hit it. Do you have any others?
Nope.
So I'm not going to cover this because we talked about this a lot, but it's almost 2 weeks ago now. It's the May 20th issue of Science had a huge section on, no, that's not, you picked up one I gave you, but you don't have any of these. This is one I skipped.
Okay.
It had a huge issue on urbanization.
Oh, wow.
You remember?
Yeah.
We talked about this in the car.
Yeah, we talked about
it
in the car.
We kept reading different articles. So there's one on the rise of the city. There's a comparison of how to handle pollution, comparing China and London as the test cases, which was fantastically interesting. There's a whole section on Vancouver and how they're trying to have like practically a zero footprint and all the stuff they're doing, but then the problems you have to face. There's with this whole thing on transportation and buses and how to design your systems right and how China's growing. So the whole section, all different articles, was really fantastic. I guess I should just pick one and just say a little bit to give an idea. I guess, and I'm not even going to go over all of it, I guess what would be the best one? I'll have to do it from memory. I have the Vancouver one up, but I think it's the one comparing air pollution in London and China.
I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah. So London's grown and Beijing and other Chinese cities have grown. The Chinese have grown at just absolutely phenomenal rates. And the air quality actually stayed pretty decent compared to what it was before. I mean, still really bad in Beijing, while it got worse in London. And the big difference was some pretty drastic steps they took in Beijing, saying basically, listen, whatever your license plate number ends in, then if it ends in this, you're not allowed to have your car driving on the roads on like Tuesdays and Thursdays. Right? And going ahead and putting a lot of work into buses and closing off areas and stuff like that. Turns out that the population of cars has still really grown, and they're going to have to do something, but you know, it's forestalled the worst of what would have happened. In London, they had all of these plants who do different things, but it was all in small areas. So I have certain downtown areas where it's a lot better that there's not no cars. But overall, in the metropolis, the pollution is so bad, it's like not having any effect. On the other hand, even though they're not growing as fast as China, there was all this government subsidies for diesel, I think it was, which means there's all of the increase, even though it was not big as it was in Beijing, it was all diesel. And that was really bad for getting the NO into the air, and that causes the photochemical smog and so on and so forth. I think it was the particulates that were particularly going up, which were unhealthy.
Right.
Anyway, so it's interesting to compare the two.
Right. No, I thought that was very interesting.
I can't remember which of the articles it was, but it was one of those from that May 20th issue. Let's see, is it Rise of the City? No, that's not it. Anyway, it's in that issue. It's very cool. That's all I have.
Okay.
Go over what we've been doing.
Yeah.
Did we cover our blogs? Let's see. No, I held mine back.
You held yours back.
What was mine?
Yours was that one.
Oh, yeah. So we're back to starting the 2-meter transmitter modules. Mm-hmm. Or 2-meter transmitter testing and building for our next set of ARDF event. I think we'll do the sprints first, because everybody will be able to have it receivers. Well, right now we don't have, I think we have like 2 meter receivers only, so that's not going to work, but it'll be cool. And I've had some problems, but the thing is, I've encountered the problems immediately, and they all have to do with 2-meter stuff. It was within 30 minutes of sitting down to work at this. Why? Because I had all of these old modules set up for the working on the 80-meter transmitter. Mm-hmm. So that was really cool. It was just ready to go. I just popped out the 80-meter part, popped in the 2-meter part. The SI-5351 was the same. Reprogrammed the 80 mega, instructed it to change the frequency to be up at 144 megahertz, and yeah, I got crap out. I don't know what to do. I think I'm going to try to test it against, maybe it's something in particular to the way we built our board. So I'm going to try the Adafruit next, and I'm going to step up slowly from 3.5 megahertz up to the 2-meter band, and see if the output of the board, you know, if there's a particular breakpoint, maybe the coding needs to be different. I don't know. Anyway, I thought I tested it and it got clean code, a clean waveform out way in the past. I think I was using the Adafruit breakout board. So maybe I'll do that next. I don't know. Anyway, my blog was just how quickly you get going when you have your modules and you can really use them.
Nice.
And we talked about yours already. Your older one.
Oh yeah, we've already talked about that. Yeah.
And you have a new one?
I do. So my new one is about setting up our last event, and just kind of what it takes. And it just goes through Pat getting on the trail by 6 a.m. and
trying
to. And at the end, it takes us anywhere between 6 and 8 hours to do this event.
It takes us more than that?
Yeah.
It takes us over 9 hours.
Yeah.
From the time we turn on the transmitters to the time we're back and the car's unloading, it's over 9 hours.
Right. And I was, you know, I was trying to be, you know, to give people the thing. And
stuff happened, like I lost my glasses. I know. So for everybody out there, and you see other people that are doing orienteering and they have these little pink things, you know, obviously, don't think to yourself, oh boy, I'm so happy my eyesight isn't that bad. Because my eyesight is not that bad. I mean, I don't need my glasses. I can drive without them. This is not a problem. Right? But they fell, and I did some stuff, and I looked over. Well, no, they didn't fall. They were on my backpack. And I put my backpack on, and then I'm like, oh, where are my glasses? And I look down, and we searched all over.
Oh, yeah.
And they couldn't have been very far.
No.
And so I searched there for like 5 minutes, and then mm-hmm. I had to get going because, mm-hmm. you know, I'm on the clock. I've got to get
right.
all the transmitters set up before the kids show up. And then during pickup, we went together, mm-hmm. and we searched all over the leaves. And they couldn't have been anywhere else.
No.
They had to be right there. And it was impossible to find them.
I know.
I don't. They just disappear in the leaves.
They do. So from now on, he's going to tie a pink little thing.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, dear. So, but, you know, when we leave at the end of the day, it's just a great feeling.
Oh, yeah.
To be able to provide that for students and their families. And just to see the joy that they get out of it.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it.
I enjoy the course setting, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that is one hard workout.
Yeah.
Interspersed with these times when I'm just setting up the mm-hmm. transmitter and everything. Yeah. So it's a fun outing.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we go back out to collect transmitters, we run into each other and that.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll start walking together. And just to recount some of the things that the students said or the parents said.
Yeah.
And like last week, we had the cutest thing where we had this parent, you know, she came back with her son and they hadn't found any foxes.
Right.
And, you know, but they weren't upset. They were just like, oh. And then they realized their mistake. They'd actually come close to, I don't know how many.
Yeah.
And then when they realized they probably could have gotten three and come back, they went back out and they got the...
See, that's the typical thing when you're first learning.
Yeah.
It's so much information in one shot.
It is.
And they went out and, you know, going off trail, this is something that was covered.
Right.
And when we were giving them the talk and stuff. But it's just one piece of a huge amount of information.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're telling them, the way they're set up, you really want to spend most of your time on the trails.
Right.
And somehow in her mind, it's like, right, I just stay on the trails.
And also, you know, for
like it's
many,
totally understandable.
Yeah. And for many people that are trying this, they aren't people that hike. And
right.
they haven't really been out wandering around yeah. in the woods without being on a very nice trail that's a good yeah. 2 to 3 foot, you know, width. And so it's a lot of fun. It's just, and then they went back out and they found the homing beacon, and then you could hear them scream and celebrate.
I know, that was so fun, so much fun.
Very cute.
You could hear the ladies scream. Okay, future plans?
Yeah. Patrick had a cool idea this morning because we're trying to think of how to set up a club in a way that could engage
middle the students,
school students and
during the club time
right. after the school day.
Right. So it has to be a relatively short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know,
like 1 to 2 hours. It
yeah.
can't be the day.
No.
You know, the whole
no.
evening.
And when right after school they aren't interested in really sitting and having a
right.
lot of, you know, and this is how you do it, and this is where what you can do, and this is some strategies. These are strategies that you can use. So Patrick had a wonderful idea where we would divide up into two teams of students, and I would take one, he would take the other, and we'd go and set a transmitter,
mm-hmm.
and then we would come back and meet in one location, and we would go find the other group's transmitter.
Yeah,
and
crisscross.
Yeah. So I thought that would be fun. And in relatively short period of time, I think we could do everything in under 2 hours.
And if the students set up the transmitters,
right,
they own the problem.
Right.
They get to fiddle with the cool stuff.
Right.
It's kind of fun putting an antenna up.
Yeah. And we don't have to put anything too high because we aren't worried about how far we're going in the
woods. Right. Because it's all going to be school
right.
grounds.
Right.
So
right.
It's all going to be pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
So that's just a fun and new idea.
And Bear Island is going to come up soon.
And Bear Island is coming up soon, which I'm really looking forward to.
I think one more thing we need to mention.
Mm-hmm.
My heroic search for people to help to get the word out.
Oh, yes. I actually wrote that down.
Did you?
Yeah, I wrote that down.
I'm not done yet, but
yeah.
I have one person from each school.
Yep. So Patrick has been going around. Under future plans. Patrick's been setting up meetings with teachers. And it is very difficult at this time of the year because the teachers are finishing up.
There's only 1 week of school left now.
They're cleaning out their rooms.
Yeah.
And they are getting grade reports back for state testing and other tests, whether it's AP or whatever. And so there's a lot of emotions, and it's a very intense time around a school in particular.
Well, not just that, but even when I first contact a school, you know, I try to find some teachers that might be interested, but I don't know anybody.
Right.
Right. So that very first one, when you don't have someone in the school, it's you're really just, you know, trying several people, no one answers, and trying a few others until you find at least one person. As soon as you have one person, they know who might be interested in it.
Right.
And so it doesn't have to happen right away.
Right.
But when you have that one person and they've agreed to help get the word out, then you're like, okay, good. Okay, so we have one person at the school. We can find some way to get some of the students interested, and maybe find someone who in the future might be interested in doing more with us. And
right.
So, yeah, we have every school.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 4 middle schools and 3 high schools. I have still 2 teachers to meet, 2 of the high schools, but we have times
good
to meet. So.
Nice.
And then we have our summer.
Yay!
Building.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have enough of the 80 meter guys to do a sprint by the fall. Maybe even a 2 meter. I really want to have the 2 meters.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let me look at this. So are we good? That's it?
Yes, we are done.
Okay, so thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure to check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Oh, yeah.